From GEICO Subconscious News, I'm Tammy Racing Thoughts, broadcasting from your brain. You think you live in a pretty safe place, but you just heard about a break-in 4 miles away, which isn't close, but it isn't far either, you know? Art Palpitations is on the scene.
I sure am, Tammy, and I don't even know why I drove out here, because as you know, you got customized renter's insurance through GEICO, so your stuff is covered.
Oh, well, that's great. Any sign of crime there, Art?
Just some light littering, Tammy, but like they say, a little litter can lead to a lot.
Wise words. It feels good to worry less. It feels good to GEICO.
Ireland's greatest inventions
on News Talk.
Good afternoon and welcome to Ireland's greatest inventions, a News Talk special to mark St. Patrick's Day. Simon Tierney with you for the next hour, and what a show we have lined up for you today. Over the past 2 weeks, News Talk listeners have been voting for their favourite Irish invention, the most history-defining acts of ingenuity from a short list of 20 extraordinary things. From the hypodermic needle to the humble cheese and onion crisp, the submarine to the guided missile. Now today, we're actually going to count down the top five as chosen by you. What will come out on top? Stick around to find out. There's a lot to get through, so thankfully I'm joined in studio by a panel of guests. Historian and Irish Times journalist Ronan McGreevy, Dr. Ruth Freeman from Research Ireland, and Saoirse Hanley, who is from The Independent. You're all very welcome, guys. Now, before we get down to the nitty-gritty, let me ask you this, and I'll start with you, Ronan, if that's okay. The 15 things that didn't make the cut, I want to know if you feel any of these should have been in the top five. So let me run through them very quickly for the listeners. So there's the ejector seat, there's the guided missile, there's the military tank, bit of a war pattern emerging there. There's the boneless corset, the disease-resistant potato, rashers, Mr. Denny to thank for that one, the Beaufort scale, the modern stethoscope, the perforated stamp, I love that one, a form of humane hanging, bit morbid, the duty-free shop, Shannon Airport in the 1940s, of course, the penalty kick, William McCrum in Armagh, responsible for that one in the 1890s, the BCG vaccine in Ireland, Dorothy Stopford Price, a real heroine of public health policy in this country, the submarine. So Ronan, which of those would you have had higher up on the list, so to speak?
Well, I have a personal bias about this because I would say the tank, because 3 years ago I wrote a book about the assassination of Field Marshal Sir Henry Wilson, which was the catalyst for the Civil War. But I subsequently found out afterwards that he had a very famous first cousin who's been rather forgotten about now, called Walter Wilson. Walter was from Kildare, and he was one of the Kildare Wilsons. But he was the man who co-invented the tank. But he also invented other things as well, including a form of manual gear stick, which was very popular in the 1930s and 1940s. And he could have been the person to have invented the aeroplane. He was involved in 1898 with a prototype airplane, but unfortunately, when his co-inventor tried to fly it, he crashed and killed himself. So as a result of that, Walter Wilson abandoned the thing, and then he went on to invent a type of car.
And Ronan, the tank is interesting because, if I'm not mistaken, it was during World War I that he was part of the team that brought it in, perhaps for the Battle of the Somme.
Yes. To be precise about it, because I often go there, is the Battle of Fleurus-Courcelette in September 1916. Basically, the idea of the tank was that it was this sort of contraption that could go on muddy ground, but also go over trenches. So it was actually long enough. Most trenches were about 10 foot wide, so to go over trenches. Now, the first ones were pretty much a disaster because they kept breaking down, because there had been no chance to actually test them. I mean, if you were to bring a tank to a modern battlefield, you'd be testing it for years before you go out there, but they had no chance to do that. But by the end of the war in 1918, you had the Mark V tank, which is the one that you see in a lot of the photographs. That was very, very effective.
It's extraordinary because it's a classic case of the immediacy of war speeding up the progress of technology. Yeah. Ruth, let me come to you. Was there anything on the long list that you would have liked to have seen higher up?
And I was a bit surprised, actually, that the submarine didn't make it higher up the list. And when you think about, you know, the submarine obviously invented by an Irish man, John Holland from County Clare, really he did a lot of his work in the US where he emigrated. So while he was a teacher over there, he came up with the concept of the submarine and he was kind of pitching it to the UK and to the US. And he didn't get very far with the UK Royal Navy at the time. But the US eventually did pick up and his initial submarine that was developed just around the turn of the 20th century, the Holland Six, you know, they took it up and then it became an integral part of battle in both.
Turn of the century. So, and then of course it was used hugely in World War One as well.
And one and two, yeah.
And the U-boats in, there was 1,000 U-boats roaming the Atlantic in the beginning of World War Two. Saoirse, surely there's not going to be another military invention that you want to see in the top.
No, I've got a lot more, I've got a much more frivolous option, duty-free. Starting in Shannon Airport.
Mm. I
think
one.
It's fascinating. When I learned, I also think, aside from it being a very cool thing to have in our bow, I think it makes a great fun fact because if you've ever been to Shannon Airport, it's tiny. You can get from A to B so fast, it like absolutely blows Dublin and Cork out of the water. I love Shannon Airport, but shout out to Shannon Airport there. But the duty-free started in 1947 there. And I'm really surprised it didn't make it higher because if you think about how much that has shaped the travel experience or the airport experience or any part of like getting from your car to the next country you're going to, like duty free, not only do you have to pass through it to get where you're going, but it's also like a very necessary stop for lots of people. It's a big cultural thing of like, you know, if you're picking up a perfume, you're getting it duty free. I got a text from a friend literally this morning who said she needs to get to an airport stop because she needs new sunglasses and she's not going to buy them anywhere else.
Can I just add to that?
Yeah, Ronan. Yeah.
Another Irish invention arising out of duty free and from Shannon Airport is Irish coffee, which apparently, was invented by a very enterprising hotelier whose name escapes me, but it was in the time of the flying boats and they were all stranded in Shannon for a while. And he came up with the idea of coffee.
Oh, the Clippers.
Yeah. And he put some whiskey in the coffee and then added some cream. And
well, it's really interesting that you mentioned that, Ronan, because there's an extraordinary photograph of Arthur Miller and Marilyn Monroe, who were a married couple, of course, in the 1950s, rather briefly, I think. But they were stopping over in Shannon Airport in 1956. And there's a photograph of Marilyn Monroe having that famous Irish coffee it was quite a glamorous restaurant in Shannon Airport in the mid-century. So many famous people stopped over there. Right, so let's get down to our business of the day. Coming in at number 5 in our countdown of Ireland's greatest inventions is the portable defibrillator. I think people might be surprised that Ireland are claiming this one. And talk about kicking off with something that's literally saved so many lives. It was Professor Frank Pantridge that finally found a way to mobilise, I suppose, this piece of equipment at the Royal Victoria Hospital in Belfast in 1965. Ruth, as perhaps our science contributor, maybe we'll start with you. Were you happy to see the portable defibrillator in the top 5?
I was happy to see it there. I mean, the reality with defibrillation, when you have to do it on the street, most people don't survive. So I mean, that is the downside of this one. But nonetheless, if you do get a defib to somebody, a first responder, about a quarter of people will survive. So in last year in Ireland, about 200 people, a first responder got a defibrillator to them. And about 50%, about 50 of those people went on to be fine. So it's having a real impact. And the other thing I would say is, you know, the initial idea, I think they used a car battery to get the charge, to get the heart rate.
Oh, in his original invention.
In his original invention, yeah. But obviously now, The AEDs that we have now, the automated ones, are incredibly easy to use. So automated electronic defibrillator or AED. And you'll see these all over the place. And what I would...
You see them like on the side of GAA clubs. You see them on street corners.
Yeah, and that's a fantastic thing to see those. But one thing I would say to people is, don't be frightened to use them, because what a lot of people don't know now is that they're really a mixture of that original technology, but some very clever electronics on top. So if you open that box, there's a big button which sort of you press and it's like press go, and the machine will talk you through how to use it. So it will actually explain to you exactly what to do with the person in front of you. I mean, the other really interesting thing about a first responder going in and dealing with someone is that we know people are much less likely to use a defibrillator on a woman. And this is because you do have to get someone down to their bare skin to use an AED because you have to get that skin-to-skin contact to get the electrical charge. So one of the things we're trying to have a conversation about is use an AED on a woman. You know, you're much better off to try and save her life than maybe to worry too much about her dignity on the side of the road. She'd probably much prefer you just to use it on
I'd
her.
Rather be alive, I think.
Yeah, you'd rather be alive. But also the instructions are there. So don't, you know, if the opportunity arises where you can help someone and you have access to an AED, take it down, open it, press the button and have a go. Because, you know, there's a chance you could save someone's life.
Yeah, Ronan, what I love about this one is that it's an example of how the technology has evolved so much since it first started. Like, I read yesterday when I was doing a little bit of research on the defib, the portable defib, Ruth mentioned that it was initially powered by a car battery. Apparently it was 70 kilos. Yeah. In weight, and now a standard one is so much lighter and smaller.
Yes, and I mean, Ruth mentioned there it saves the lives of 50 people in Ireland every year. How much do you multiply that to get what you would save globally on an annual basis?
That's
given that
true.
We're 0.01% of the world's, but one in a thousand. So maybe you're looking at 50,000 people whose lives are saved by that. And, you know, there's nothing more shocking. I've seen this in my own experience of people who die suddenly from heart disease or from heart cardiac arrest. The relatives never get over that. So there's all those, not just you're saving lives, but you're saving so much heartbreak for so many people.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to stick with you very quickly because we need to move on to number four on our list, Ronan. Number four is boycotting, mm-hmm. right? This is an interesting one because people might be surprised to think of this as an invention, but the word boycott actually does come from the name of a person who spent a considerable amount of time in this country, Captain Charles Boycott.
Yes.
What do you know about this fella?
Well, I know he is a sort of bête noir in Irish history, probably not as much as Cromwell or others, but in fact, he was the wrong man in the wrong place at the wrong time. Essentially, he wasn't the worst. He was first of all, he wasn't a landlord. He was an agent of a landlord. And the landlord in question was a guy called Lord Erne, who owned about 70,000 acres, I think, in Mayo. A lot of it was bad land and so on. And what happened was that in the late 1870s, early 1880s, there was a global downturn.
Right.
In agricultural prices collapsed. There was also a series of bad harvests, particularly one in 1879. So farmers couldn't pay their rent. And Erne decided that he was going to increase the amount of rent that they had to pay by 25%. There was a massive, I'm going to say boycott, there was a massive massive backlash against that from Parnell and from the Land League. You might have heard the famous saying about shun him in the marketplace, shun him
so
in the
church. So this backlash was sort of a passive, collective.
It was, and this is the genius of it. It was not, there wasn't violence involved in this. It was not doing something. It was not doing something. And not doing something was cooperating with this man who was not the worst chap in the world, but he was caught in the wrong place at the wrong time. He was, Lord Erne tried to evict 11 tenants who wouldn't pay their rent, and all hell broke loose. Everybody withdrew their labour from him, so boycott couldn't get the harvest saved. And then, of course, the British authorities didn't want to set an example for this, but they actually did. So they brought in Orangemen from the north, they brought in labourers from the UK at vast expense. But eventually boycott just... He was boycotted and he had to leave.
Boycott was boycott.
Yes.
Before I go to the ad break, Saoirse, were you surprised to discover that boycott was an actual person? I mean, it's a word that we use so much. That's used globally.
Yeah, it's a fascinating study in like etymology, I think, because for me, like, I genuinely had no idea that it came from that. And it sounds so wrong when you say it, like when you say, miss, like, you know, any kind of Mr. Boycott, it just to our ears just sounds so wrong, because I'm like, how can you name somebody after a practice? But it's the practice named after the person. And I think it's great. I think it's particularly...
it's the Hoover effect, isn't it?
People
forget that there was a Mr. Hoover that came up with the Hoover.
And it almost sounds like it's somebody who just decided to name themselves that because of the concept, but we got it from them. And it's great that it's an Irish one, because, you know, we're quite good at that. We're quite good at the rebellious spirit. So it's good that we kind of kept that up.
Okay, it's time for a quick break. You're listening to Ireland's Greatest Invention with me, Simon Tierney. Back after this.
Ireland's Greatest Inventions
on News Talk.
Welcome back to Ireland's Greatest Invention, a special News Talk show celebrating Irish ingenuity this St. Patrick's Day, with me, Simon Tierney, here with you this hour, and my panel, of course, Ruth Freeman, Ronan McGreevy and Saoirse Hanley. Now, next up in our countdown is number 3. The bronze medal goes to the digital computer. Now, while we can't claim an Irish person directly invented the first ever computer, we are recognising a mathematician from Donegal by the name of Kay McNulty, who was one of the original programmers of the ENIAC, the world's first general purpose computer, in 1945. Now, the story of Kay McNulty is interesting in that it reminds me of that movie Hidden Figures a few years ago. Wonderful film about the extraordinary women who were really the unsung heroes on the Apollo program in the 1960s. And Ruth Freeman, let me come to you first, because there's a sense here too that the invention of the computer wouldn't have been possible without Kay and her compatriots, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it is history did really repeat itself, from Kay's story to those women who were portrayed in Hidden Figures, and even to today to some extent. But of course, the word computer, it was a person who did computations.
That's true. She was a computer.
Yeah. Exactly. And the original programming that she did, you know, was done on paper. There was no keyboards and screens. The interfaces that we associate with computers didn't exist. She was moving cables around and making this, building up the original language of programming and how we get machines to do things. But the story of Kay McNulty, it's hard not to get a bit angry when you hear the story, I think.
Why is that?
Because of this unsung nature of what she did. And, you know, there's a number of things about her story that are kind of interesting. So obviously she left Ireland when she was only 3, and she ended up over in Pennsylvania. And of course, she got an education in the US that she could never have got in Ireland. And that's a real shame, because you think about all the other girls in Ireland at that time who maybe could have could have been if they'd had access to that. And in fact, even today, our girls' schools in Ireland don't offer the same range of STEM and engineering and technology type subjects to girls. So we still need to sort that out in honour of Kay McNulty. And of course, the other side of it is that really she met her husband on the project. He was an engineer.
John,
many years older than her. And of course, when they got married, she had to stop work. And really, she was never even mentioned in the whole history of how these first digital computers...
And often wasn't paid.
And even herself, much later in life, when she talked about the project, she was often called to talk about the project, to talk about her husband's work, even though in the background she did continue to work on it, work on his work with him.
Yeah, well, let me stop you there, because last night I was watching a fascinating interview with Kay and John from, I think, the mid to late 1970s on American television. Now, of course, she came from Donegal, but she lived most of her life in America, so you'll hear her American accent in this clip. But she talks a little bit about her work on the ENIAC. Have a listen to this.
But gradually, as the project for of the ENIAC construction went on, Moore School hired more and more women. So it was very obvious that there were very, very many more women, and they were working at, the wiring jobs that were going on. And I don't know where they had recruited the girls from, but they weren't all college graduates or anything like that.
Okay, so that was Kay McNulty speaking there in the 1970s about her work on the world's first digital computer, which was invented in the 1940s. Ronan, we mentioned at the beginning of the programme about the original defibrillator being this massive 70-kilo machine. This computer, like, we think of computers as small objects nowadays, but this computer, the first computer. It weighed 30 tons. It's hard to visualize this machine that Kay McNulty would have been working on, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there's an often repeated quote, isn't there, that there's more computational power in our mobile phones than there was in the Apollo missions, and I'd well believe that. Just to go back to Ruth's point there, I was pretty shocked. I didn't know this, but we had a marriage bar in the Republic until 1973 when we had to change it because of the having joined the EEC. I didn't realise that marriage bars existed in a lot of other different countries as well, including the United States.
I was really surprised when Ruth said that. Yeah.
And in Germany as well, I remember the German ambassador, previous German ambassador, saying, you know, that in West Germany they had a very strict marriage bar, whereas in East Germany they didn't. Just to get back to Kay, if I might say that there are a lot of unsung female scientists and inventors. And one I'd like to mention who's Irish is Jocelyn Bell Burnell, who discovered the radio pulsar in 1967 as a 24-year-old student. I remember interviewing her many years ago for the Irish Times. She did not get the Nobel Prize for Physics. It was given to her supervisor, Anthony Hewish, and another astronomer, Martin Ryle. And that's been an ongoing source of friction for the last 60 years or so. Has to be said that Jocelyn Bell Burnell has got over it a long time ago, but still people feel that she should have got the Nobel Prize for Physics.
Yeah. And actually, On Puss just released a stamp last week with Professor Jocelyn Bell Burnell on it. So we
I was
still alive, I think.
She is, yeah.
Well, that brings me to an interesting question about how we represent these people in popular culture. Saoirse, there was a piece that I researched and wrote a couple of years ago for the Irish Examiner about the dearth of public art commemorating women in this city and in the capital, in Dublin. And I just wonder, do you think it would help, I suppose, inspire the next generation if we had a little bit more public representation in our statuary, in the way buildings are named and things like that, of women?
Yeah, I think it definitely is a motivator for people to kind of see the heights that women before them have gotten to. But I think there's definitely been an interesting conversation in the past couple of years about what is existing in terms of what we are like, what statues we have, say, or what we have, you know, libraries named after or streets named after and all that kind of stuff. And
we've got the Evan Boland Library.
Yes, yeah. And even though, like, I think Wolfe Tone was the public choice, but I thought it was the right decision
I think it's that kind of like slight revision of the stuff that we have and looking at it and examining that and thinking, what can we turn that into that will better inspire people? I think that's a good way forward, because even there's a lot of things that I think we have that are obviously quite outdated, or things that we, I think, have kind of turned into a way of almost people wanting to succeed more in spite. A great example is the statue, I'm going to have to get the name of this, but the statue that's in Trinity College, of the man who said that women would cross the threshold of the university over his dead body. And now it's a big thing for people who graduate from Trinity, for women in particular, to stand in front of that statue in their kind of their big grad robes and say, well, I did, you know. And I think it's that kind of thing of, it is really important to recognise the amazing women that have been there. But I think not only that, it's important to look at the existing, I suppose, homages that we have and how we can turn them into something that's slightly better or better reflects the Ireland that we have now, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's Kay McNulty. She was number 3 on our list. Now, we're going to move on to number 2. And as they say in Monty Python, it's time for something completely different, because in second place on our countdown of Ireland's greatest inventions, ahead of the military tank and the submarine route, is the humble cheese and onion crisp. Yes, indeed. It was here in Dublin that Joe Murphy mastered the recipe in 1954 for his nascent business empire, Tato. Have a listen to this clip.
Captain Tato has at last located the stolen shipment of Tato crisps. By the time he's landed, he has a good idea who the culprits are. The dreaded Odgehats, sole inhabitants of the planet Egardnet.
We've got to stop the Odgehats before they deflavorize all 10 varieties of our crisps. Okay, Odgehats, the game's up. I've something better planned for you.
Tato crisps are returned to planet Earth. Tato, dig into a bag. You may save the world.
Ronan, Irish people are very protective and proud of their crisps, which I don't think will come as a surprise to you. It isn't a surprise, therefore, perhaps, to see it on the list on a popular vote like this, is it?
Well, if you think about it in terms of... I kind of vaguely knew the story, but I wasn't aware that there were... He didn't invent the crisp as such. He invented the flavour crisp, where it's part of the production process. I wasn't aware of that. Obviously, we all know that it's an established fact that Tato was the best crisp brand in the world. I'm happy to die on this hill, and I have done so with so many people over the years, and saying absolutely. And when you think about. Not only as an Irish invention, I mean, it's a worldwide thing now. Everywhere you go, there are flavour crisps. And I wasn't aware until now that this was an Irish invention. So I think it deserves to be there.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think the way it worked before pre-1954, if there was going to be any flavour introduced to a packet of crisps, was that you would have salt and shake. So you might have like a little sachet of salt in the bag that you would open and dispense yourself. It was almost like you had to do the work for the company that had produced the crisp.
It also sounds tragic. That's it. It really doesn't sound that. And I like a ready salted crisp. I'm not against it. But the idea of being handed a bag of flavourless crisp is actually really abhorrent to me.
I remember, Saoirse, when I was living in London many years ago, because you can't really get Tato in the UK.
You can't get it anywhere outside Ireland, which is
mind-boggling. Yeah, they haven't really travelled. But I think there's a reason for this, Ronan, is because I brought a packet of cheese and onion Tato crisps over to London for my then girlfriend, who was English and lived over there. And I remember her tasting them for the first time and being taken aback by how strong they were. They're actually a very strongly flavoured crisp. Like, if you compare them to British imitators, such as Walkers.
Imitators is the word.
They're a much milder crisp, aren't they?
They are. And I think it rings true for salt and vinegar too, because a Walker's salt and vinegar is grand. It's nice. But there's a real sharpness to a Tato salt and vinegar, I think.
Again, that's much better.
There's an ad around, sorry to interrupt you, there's an ad around at the moment involving some of the most famous footballers in the world. Messi's one of them, Neymar, Luis Suarez, and they're doing the Lays. You know, these are L-E-Y-S, they're Lays.
Oh, Lays.
They're American.
Yeah, yeah.
They're disgusting.
Yeah, you see them in a lot of European
countries. But they're a worldwide crisp brand that wouldn't probably exist but for Joe Murphy.
Yeah. Ruth, it's an extraordinary story because I think I mentioned at the top there that this was mid-1950s Ireland.
Yeah.
There was a kind of an emerging entrepreneurial spirit, but it's still pre-Sean Lamass and the kind of small economic miracle that would begin in the 1960s.
It was kind of science-based. So, I mean, it was a technology that they came up with. So cheese and onion was just the first flavour that they came up with. But the technology was to coat potato crisps while still keeping them crispy. Mm. And in a way, like that whole flavourings industry and all the food companies that are here and everywhere else, I mean, that's really where some of this started. I'm not sure I would have put cheese and onion there. I'm more of a salt and vinegar person. But at least in Ireland, we've kind of stuck to our knitting. But actually, this technology has really been taken and used in quite perverse ways in other countries. I mean, we have quite bizarre crisp flavours everywhere. I think the most bizarre I could find, and I think Walkers may have been responsible for some of these, we've had squirrel-flavoured crisps, we've had hedgehog-flavoured crisps, we've had lemon mint, we've had wasabi.
May contain hedgehog.
They don't. And they got in trouble for that because actually it was pork, but they called them hedgehog flavoured. But, you know, the technology at the heart of it is still the same technology.
Well, isn't there an interesting controversy over the last few months over EU regulations with flavouring? Smoky bacon flavour is that there's a chance that companies might not be able to use it as much as they used to. Crisps is an interesting one. I think one of the interesting things for me before we go to the ad break is that marketing was massive for this, Ronan, because Joe Murphy, he saw that if he got the ads right. I think in your newspaper, actually, in the 1950s, was the first place that he ever advertised. But the whole Mr. Tato thing and everything, there's been a massive marketing thing around making this as iconic as it has become, wasn't there?
Absolutely. And I mean, kids grew up with that sort of Mr. Tato thing. I mean, I think you can tell what age an Irish person is how much a packet of crisps cost when they were young. And I have to confess, I remember when they were 6 pence. I'm sorry. It's a long time ago. But
that's really interesting, because now we can tell the age difference between you and me. This is radio, so people can't see it. But I remember when a packet of cheese and onion Tato crisps were 20 pence.
Right.
And you said...
Six pence.
Okay, it's a few years. Ruth, do you remember how
good
they were?
I'm going to say the high teens, 20. Yeah.
Yeah, see, we're a bit closer.
Yeah.
Now, I definitely had the euros.
So. 1 euro. 1 euro.
It was definitely euro or something in my memory.
Great. So listen, when we come back after this break, it will be drum roll time for our number one on the list of Ireland's greatest inventions. This is a special News Talk show celebrating Irish ingenuity this St. Patrick's Day with me, Simon Tierney, this hour, and my panel, Ruth Freeman, Ronan McGreevy and Saoirse Hanley. We'll be back after this.
Ireland's greatest inventions on News Talk.
Welcome back to Ireland's greatest invention, a special News Talk show celebrating Irish inventions this St. Patrick's Day. Me, Simon Tierney, here with you this hour. And Ruth Freeman is still with me, Ronan McGreevy and Saoirse Hanley. Right, it is time for the drum roll. No messing around. Here's the biggie. Number one on the list of Ireland's greatest inventions, as voted for by News Talk listeners over the past 2 weeks, is the hypodermic needle. It was Dr. Francis Rind in the Meath Hospital, just down the road from us, actually, here at Marconi House, near Portobello on Heytesbury Street, who finally found a way to safely and effectively deliver subcutaneous medicine using a needle in 1844. Now, Ruth Freeman, let me come to you, because it sort of beggars belief that there isn't a statue to this man in Dublin. What do we know about Francis Rind creating this hypodermic needle, and why was it so significant?
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't the first person who had thought of this idea to put medicine directly under the skin, and I think a UK physician had come up with the idea of using a quill to put it under. But Francis was treating this woman. She had neuralgia, she had pain in her face, and she tried drinking morphine to make the pain go away, and it just wouldn't work. So he did two things. He sort of had one needle that was almost a very small knife, like a scalpel, and he made a small incision, and then he used a cannula, or a hollow bore needle, exactly like what we have today. And he just used that to let gravity let the morphine get in.
So there was no plunger or syringe, so to speak?
No, there was no plunger in the original. Although that came quite quickly. It was within about a decade people were making syringes with that plunger. So just gravity got the medicine directly to the site. And of course, this woman said she had the best night's sleep she'd had for ages. And in some ways, after the plunger was added, really the technology broadly had stayed the same for nearly 200 years. So obviously we now have disposable syringes, sterile syringes. We have much shorter and much finer needles. But mostly it's essentially the same. And it's hard to, as you say, it's hard to overstate the impact of this. I mean, vaccines obviously is one of the key technologies that uses needles. And I mean, vaccines alone, there's been a study which says in the last 50 years that over 154 million deaths have been prevented by the use of vaccines. And that's before you even get to all the other uses of needles. So look, I suppose it's a technology not everybody loves needles. In fact, they often elicit a shudder when you talk to people about having to go and get a needle.
I know, but I love the idea of of gravity having to do its work, of there being no plunger, because like when you get a needle injection now, it's quite quick, but can you imagine having to wait for gravity to, put the liquid inside?
Yeah. Sometimes I think, you know, like there's people who say they'd love to have been alive during a certain period. I'm totally fine with being alive now. I am absolutely grand. There's no, I had to be that poor woman with the neuralgia who had to have this kind of experimental needle put in my face. I'm out of here.
PJ O'Rourke on that subject, PJ O'Rourke said, he said the best cure for nostalgia is one word, dentistry.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. It's interesting you say that. I recently read that classic 1970s thriller, Marathon Man, which of course was made into the famous movie with Laurence Olivier playing a Nazi dentist as the last person you ever want to meet. Ronan, what I love about this story is that Francis Rind came up with this hypodermic needle in the Meath Hospital. It's one of those institutions that you come across in books every now and then. And it reminds me of the story of Dorothy Stopford Price, who we covered on the Moncrief show earlier this week as part of this project of Ireland's Greatest Inventions, because she introduced the BCG vaccine in St. Olten's Hospital for Infants, another hospital that doesn't exist anymore. These kind of institutions that no longer exist in our public psyche or in our cities, they were groundbreaking places in many ways. Like when we think of medical institutions in Ireland, you kind of shudder sometimes because they have such awful reputations in some ways. But it's great to celebrate the public health ingenuity that was also taking place in another way, isn't it?
Yeah, it's amazing. I came across this guy about 10 to 12 years ago. In fact, he was honoured, I think, by the College of Surgeons. But I don't know whether, as you say, whether there's a bus to him or not. But a lot of medical people who have invented things that have saved millions and millions of lives are not properly acknowledged at all. Ruth mentioned vaccination there. When I go to London, there are two statues that get my make my blood boil. The first one is a statue of Cromwell outside the House of Commons, and then outside in Whitehall, there's the statue of Douglas Haig, the butcher of the First World War. I would replace those two statues. One to Edward Jenner, who Ruth mentioned there. Edward Jenner invented the vaccine in 1795, the smallpox vaccine. Smallpox was responsible for wiping out hundreds of millions of people and including civilizations in places like in Mexico and the United States and so on. I would put him where Cromwell is. And the other one is, the other person who I believe is responsible for saving the lives of hundreds of millions of people is Alexander Fleming, who invented penicillin in 1928. These people are not acknowledged properly. And again, yeah, as you say with Francis Rind, it's not just how many, I don't know how many lives that process has saved, but you think it's also the process that's involved in intravenous drips as well.
Yeah.
And in blood transfusions, all of that kind of stuff. So, you know, this is a really important person. And it's, I think generally speaking, societies are far too quick to honour and praise and put up statues to people who were politicians or were army generals whose business was killing people, instead of to the people who really matter, who are the people who save lives. And just one last thing I would say in relation to saving lives. I had the privilege about 10 years ago of meeting Dr. Dennis Salmon, who was the inventor of the breast cancer drug Herceptin. And if you ever see, there's a movie called Living Proof, which you can see on YouTube. That man has saved tens of millions of lives of women who are alive today because of what he did. And it was a great privilege to meet him. They're the real heroes of this world.
I think often the scientists and medical professionals, they tend to work away quietly without blowing their own trumpet, so to speak. Because they're so passionate about their work rather than passionate about putting themselves forward first. Ruth, as someone from a science background, one thing I don't quite understand about Francis Rind's invention, and the listeners might be interested to understand better, is, you know, he tried to give this woman who was suffering with neuralgia, I think perhaps a solution of morphine orally, or maybe a pill or something like that. Yeah. What I don't understand is, why was it so much better, or why was there an ambition to deliver medicine hypodermically under the skin? Why was that considered better than taking a solution of medicine?
Yeah, well obviously, I mean, nowadays we take medicines in all sorts of different forms, and we try to optimize whatever we're trying to treat with the best kind of administration. But in this case, I mean, if you're taking morphine, it's going into your digestive system.
That's
so it's going
true.
Into your stomach, into all of that hydrochloric acid. And, you know, it's taking an awfully long time, and it's been diluted significantly by the time it gets to the site of the pain. Whereas this was a much more, you could put a dose directly in.
It's targeted.
It's targeted, exactly. And, you know, as Ronan was saying, like the idea of, you know, even diabetics being able to administer insulin directly into their blood using a needle, there's so many uses of this. And but one thing I think that stands out when you talk about medical and scientists and innovators, when you look today how we produce doctors, we do it in Ireland through a very kind of rigorous, highly academic process where you have to really be very book smart. And that's really, really important because there's an awful lot to do. But when you look at Pantridge and when you look at Francis Rind, they had kind of a rebel spirit. They weren't necessarily people who just did exactly what you would expect them to do. They were prepared to try things. And I think, you know, we need to almost...
That's a really interesting point. They were prepared to fail, perhaps.
They were prepared to fail in a way that maybe we don't tolerate. And maybe we don't even encourage those types of people into these fields anymore because of the way that we bring people in. I mean, it is the people who never fail who go and do medicine in Ireland. So where do we get medical innovation, you know, again? And again, we need to bring, I think, scientists, engineers and doctors together to work on some of these problems so we can come up with the new wave of solutions.
And look, there's also the culture of health and safety as well. I mean, nowadays, you know, can you imagine the Wright brothers trying to get permission to fly their plane? You know, I'm quite serious about that.
I mean,
the sort of maverick inventor who, as you say, as Ruth says, was prepared to fail. That kind of culture, I don't think that culture is there anymore. I mean, the genius single person in their room trying to invent things, that doesn't really work anymore. Can you imagine as well if Francis Rind was, I'm going to just put this piece of steel in your face. You know, what the loops they would have to go through nowadays. Yeah,
we sometimes don't admire the entrepreneurial spirit. I mean, when I came up with the idea of fizzy milk, no one seemed to be interested in it. I just don't know why.
Crying shame.
my great invention in life is square sausages. So you know the way you never can just
square
quite,
sausages.
So you put them on the pan. They go and you get them perfectly evenly cooked. Whereas with a round sausage, sometimes they curl up and you don't get them cooked properly. And
Ronan,
all
I think that's a great idea.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah.
I think if any seed investors are listening, I think
I'm going to walk out of here and patent it straight away before someone else gets the idea.
Mine is a spray tan machine operation that actually puts SPF on you for holidays. And it like lasts. I would love. I mean, me and my mom have had this. Like that's Sir Stanley Julie Walsh patent. I promise. That we've talked about our whole lives. And we're going on holidays as kids, and it's obviously really frustrating to get sun cream on three children. I mean, my mom used to always say, "Wouldn't it be so amazing if you could just step into like a spray tan machine, but it was actually spraying SPF on you, and somehow it lasted for like your whole holiday."
Brilliant. Now I've got an image of Ross from Friends getting spray tan,
basically,
but he's getting SPF rather than spray tan. And before we come to an end, because the clock is against us. There were a couple of other things that are Irish inventions ostensibly, but they don't feature on our list and that we should perhaps give an honourable mention to. You did mention, Ronan, just before we went on air, about Irish whiskey, of course.
Yes.
With an E at the end.
Yes, that's right. There is a dispute between ourselves and the Scots as to who invented it. I mean, it was... Basically, whiskey's very unusual, and I think it was discovered by accident because everybody had this aqua libra, which is, you know, distilled spirit like barley or wheat or whatever. So obviously, what happens is the monks put it into a barrel, an oak barrel, to keep it, preserve it, and after a few years, they realised that it had turned into this brown liquid that had taken on the flavour of the barrel.
Delicious.
So brown liquid. 14. Apparently, the
first, how did they make it so good?
Yeah, well, it was an accident actually, but it was it's one of the great inventions. As somebody said, the Irish invented whiskey so they wouldn't end up ruling the world. But it was I think it was first codified or written down in 1405, and then the first time it's mentioned in any Scottish literature is in the 1450s. So I think we can claim that
That's good to get that chronology in there. That's interesting. Ishka Baha. I love the way it's described. Yes. Oskelga. Now, I'm afraid that's all we have time for on this News Talk special celebrating Ireland's greatest invention. All the inventions that we've talked about are on the News Talk website on newstalk.com/IGI. That's IGI for Ireland's greatest invention. If you want to see them there with their dates and the people who are responsible, my thanks to Dr. Ruth Freeman, Saoirse Hanley and Rona McGreevy, who have provided such an interesting and colourful discussion for us today. So thank you to you all so much. And thanks also to producer Jack MacDonald and Stephen McLoone on sound. I'm Simon Tierney. A happy St. Patrick's Day to you all. And thank you for listening.